Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. With me today is Jeff Ponchik, who's a talent and A&R manager at the YouTube multi-channel network Fullscreen. But first, let's talk about basic metadata for your online music. Now, metadata is data about data. So in other words, it's data all about your file. It's all the info about your file. And it's really important that you fill this in. Now, this is for both AC3s and MP3s, and also for other files that can contain it, like broadcast wave files. So you really want to fill this in as much as you can. And the reason why is this is what determines who gets paid when it gets streamed or downloaded. It also helps music supervisors. So in other words, if a music supervisor is looking for something, they'll do a search, and any of this data can help them find something that they're looking for. What kind of metadata do you actually use? The first thing is the name of the artist. That seems like a no-brainer, but it's something that you have to put in. Next thing is the name of the songwriter. And once again, this seems like a no-brainer, but you'd be surprised the number of times this is actually missed. Number three is the song title. So everybody gets that. And the one thing that they often don't get right, though, is the proper name of the song. So in other words, if your song has an apostrophe in it, waiting for the sun instead of waiting for the sun, you should put it exactly the way your publishing is, exactly the way it is on the album, whatever the case. So that should be the proper title. The next thing would be the album title. So the album title should also be in your metadata. Whatever this comes from, make sure you put the album title as well. The record label comes next. If you don't have a record label, make one up. And you should have one anyway because it looks more professional, even if you put unknown, the unknown record label. Next would be the publisher. So if you have a music publisher, make sure you put that in, whoever that is. The year the song was released is also very important. So you put that in. The track number of the song on the album is also important, so if this is track number 7 on the album, make sure you include that. The musical genre that the song falls into is very important, especially for music supervisors. So if this is a alt-rock song, make sure you put that in. If it's a subgenre of a particular genre, like a speed metal, make sure you put that in. The producer comes next. You should also put the producer in because sometimes people are searching for songs that the producer did, and this will help them find something that's connected to them. The next thing would be the contact, and this should be either yours or your management. So whoever you want to have people contact, make sure you have that in there. Very important, because a lot of times people really love a song. They want to get in touch with you because they want to use it for something, and they don't know how to. If you're affiliated with the performing rights organization like ASCAP, BMI, or CSAC, make sure you include that. And finally, two really big ones that are so often overlooked. The first is the mood of the song. So for instance, if it's a sad song, happy song, whatever it is, make sure you include that because, again, music supervisors are often looking for that and they'll do a search just for the mood, so they can fit it into their television program, the movie, whatever it may be. And finally, the BPM of the song, which again is more for music soups than anything else. So this is the basic metadata that every song that you put online should have. And again, it's data about data, it's info about your files, and it determines who gets paid and it helps music supervisors. Next, I'd like to talk about my 10 favorite plugins that I use all the time. Now, this is only something that pertains to me, but a lot of people write in and they ask, so what do you use? And I would like to tell them. I've already written about this on my blogs, but if you don't read my blog, then this is a way that you can get the same information. So what are my favorite 10 plugins? The first one is the Pro Tools 7-Band EQ. I like this because it has filters, first of all, high and low pass filters, which I use all the time. The second reason why I like it is it doesn't take a lot of system resources, so you can add a lot of them and you don't have to worry about overloading the processor or running into any kind of problems where it's going to slow down Pro Tools or slow down whatever you're working on. My next favorite is the Universal Audio 1176LN. So that's 1176. I happen to like the low noise version, the LN version, which is the blackface version. And I use this a lot on everything, mostly because the hardware version I used for a long time. And you get used to the sound of something. And even though this isn't exactly the same, it's close enough. And I like the way it works as well. So I use this a lot. Number three would be the PSP Vintage Warmer. PSP makes great products. You should look them up because they really have some terrific things. They're not really expensive. And one of my favorites is the Vintage Warmer. I use this just about on every track across the stereo bus. It's a compressor, it's a limiter, but it really adds a glue that many times you can't get with anything else. Number five would be the Lexicon PCM Native Hall. Lexicon has made great products for such a long time, especially their reverbs. They've always been in the forefront of terrific sounding reverbs, and their plugins are no exception. They really sound great. I happen to use the Hall version a lot, and I'll use it on just about every instrument and vocals and quite a lot. There's other versions as well. There's a plate, there's a chamber, and I'll use those as well, but I happen to use this a lot more than anything else. Number five is the Universal Audio LA-3A. Well, again, the LA-3A may be the most perfect compressor ever for guitars. And again, I've used the hardware forever in the studio when I could find it, and now I'm really happy to be able to get this as a plug-in, and I use it all the time exclusively on guitars. Sometimes it works on bass, sometimes it works on keyboards, but for sure, it's a great plug-in for a guitar. Number six is Soundtoy's MicroShift. Way back in the early studio days, we didn't have a lot of effects. And back then, you might have had a primitive digital delay, which was made also by Eventide. But mostly, you had just reverb, you had a delay, you had some outboard compressors, and that's it. But the very first different kind of modulation device that became available was the Harmonizer. And first it was the Model 910, then it was the 949, and it went on from there, became more and more modern. One of the things that we used to do on the 949 would be to detune one side, the left side of a vocal, for instance, down, and detune the other side up. And what that would do would add a really cool sound, especially if a vocalist or vocalists, background vocals, for instance, were slightly out of tune. This would give it a sound that you would completely forget about the out-of-tuneness. The other thing it does is it adds an interesting sound on keyboards and guitars, and it's just full and different sounding, and you can't get that sound any other way other than to have a harmonizer. Well, Soundtoys has come up with the MicroShift that basically has three presets. There's two that come from the original harmonizers, and the third one comes from the old AMS that did the same thing. And these are the most favorite presets that everybody used. So anyway, that's one of my favorites, and I use it an awful lot. Number seven is the TT Dynamic Range Meter. The TT Dynamic Range Meter is a free plugin, and what it does is it measures your dynamic range. You put it across a stereo bus, and it will tell you how hard you're squashing things. If you're squashing things and your dynamic range is 3 or 4 dB, wow, that's probably way too much. And if it's somewhere 10, 12, somewhere in there, that's probably pretty good. It's probably about right. You might want to go to 7 dB, whatever the case. There's also a nice mono feature, so if you can't put your mix into mono any other way, this does it. That's free. Just look up TT Dynamic Range Meter, do a Google search, and like I say, it's a free download. It's very cool. Next is the Pro Tools Long Delay. Now, this is just a standard native plugin. I use it all the time, the stereo delay. I find that I like this better than some of the other delay plugins that you can get from various manufacturers. Even though they may sound a little bit better, this works really well for me. And once again, we're only talking about plugins that I like to use. But anyway, I like to use this a lot. I use it for Haas effect, in other words, very, very short delays, stereo delays. I use it for medium delays for room sounds. I use it for longer delays. I use it on vocals. I use it on guitars and keyboards. It's a really, really nice plugin that also doesn't take up a lot of system resources, which is another reason why I like to use it. And finally, the Sample Magic Magic AB, which is one of my new favorites. And what happens with this is it allows you to AB other mixes to the mix that you're doing. So in other words, you don't have to import a mix and then solo it up to listen against your current mix. You can just put this across a stereo bus and you can have up to 9 different mixes that you can actually go AB against. And this is great to tell you if perhaps the low end isn't right. This will really tell you immediately. You'll have a listen and you'll go, oh, wait a second, I'm missing something there. Okay, that sounds pretty good. Or, whoa, that's way, way too big. So these are my 10 favorite plugins. Again, it's not anything that I specifically recommend. It's just that these work great for me and I use them all the time. If you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. My guest today is Jeff Ponchik, who's a talent and A&R manager at the YouTube multi-channel network Fullscreen. He's also a co-founder of the really cool online video service called OutListen. I talked to Jeff in his office at Fullscreen via Skype. Jeff, thanks so much for being in my inner circle.
How's it going? Thank you for having me here.
First of all, tell us all about Fullscreen and what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. So Fullscreen is a multi-channel YouTube network, and it's a very, very sort of new media type job. The best way to sort of explain it is I would say it's sort of a hybrid talent and ad agency for the largest channels on YouTube. And really the value that we provide to YouTube channels, it really kind of boils down to 3 buckets. The first being essentially technology. First and foremost, we're a technology company. So channels who join the Fullscreen network get access to essentially a suite of tools that are exclusive to the network. And that could include, you know, tools such as analyzing a musician's uploads and being able to see when, you know, that musician's audience is on YouTube and give them better suggestions on when to upload their content to YouTube. So things to sort of help our creators at scale help themselves. The second aspect is sales. So we have a nationwide sales team where we are constantly bringing in brands in the form of actual advertising on top of the creators within our network's YouTube channels to increase the revenue that they would normally get, their CPMs, as we like to call it, on YouTube, to actually in-content brand shout-outs and brand integrations. And then the third part, sort of in terms of what we do here at Fullscreen, is actually what I do, and that is YouTube strategy and management. So I over here work with our top electronic dance music and hip-hop creators, and that's people ranging from Porter Robinson, Tech N9ne at Strange Music, you know, the world's biggest DJs, to independent people who have created their own followings on YouTube, and I help them with strategy and making sure that, you know, monetization is, you know, completely optimized and that, you know, they are really utilizing YouTube in a way that's going to reinforce sort of their like higher level career goals, if that makes sense.
So you're acting like an A&R guy.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, we're, you know, with YouTube, it's very heavily data driven. So a lot of it is, you know, crunching the numbers, looking at the data, seeing where their audience is. And in a lot of cases, especially on YouTube, you know, your audience will kind of dictate what they want, because it is also a social network. So yeah, so we're just kind of helping, you know, what I'm doing is helping musicians and artists understand their audiences on YouTube and help them craft, you know, better content strategy moving forward. So yes, it's very much A&R, you know. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you do talent acquisition as well? Do you go out and look for new artists that might work within the network?
Yeah, absolutely. So Fullscreen is the largest multi-channel YouTube network. It's the number one multi-channel YouTube network as rated by Comscore. And yeah, that's a really big part of it is, you know, going out, you know, much like a traditional agent would do and, you know, secure talent to work with and bring into the network. For me, what it always boils down to is what is a person's capacity for creating content on YouTube. So whether you're, you know, the biggest channel on YouTube or someone just starting out, you know, do you have the capacity to be, you know, constantly creating content on YouTube. And if that's the case, we think there's something there, then, full screen will want to work with you and try and help you grow your audience.
Now, when you say constantly creating content, does that mean every day, every other day? What does that mean in terms of uploads?
Yeah, when it comes to YouTube, sort of consistency is really key. Obviously you want to be putting out the highest quality content, but you also want to, it is in some instances a more or less a quantity play too. So what I mean by consistent is, whether it's I put out a video a month, I put out a video, once a week or once a day, it doesn't really matter. Just as long as whatever you sort of set as your sort of like content release schedule, that you can stick to it and that you have the capability to do that. A big problem that you see a lot of large artists and brands falling into, or aspiring brands falling into, is that they'll put a ton of money into making some really high quality content to put up on YouTube. And then they kind of, I don't know if you can sort of, I guess this is a podcast, so I can say this, they blow their nut, yeah. Right? And then they can't make another video for 6 months. And that's just not how you play the YouTube game. That's not how you find success. So, to answer your question, it really boils down to just finding people that can be consistent.
Is there a frequency that you find that's the most effective? In other words, is it like... I'll tell you what I found out with blogging, which I do two blogs every day, except on the weekend. And the whole key is, again, being consistent, just like you're saying, and putting out at exactly the same time. But the more you do it, the greater the audience, no matter what. And that's kind of a key. So, and it's tough. It's tough to do something like that every day. I could imagine, it must be even harder with the video as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It really depends on the content type. I want to say that yes, more is better than less. But we work with channels who will put out a video once a month or once every 2 months, and what they're doing is really special, and that's more than enough, and that's successful on YouTube. The best example I like to give is there's someone by the name of Olga Kay, who is she's not a musician by any means. She's just a YouTube sort of vlogger and creator. And she uploads, I believe, I don't know if she's still doing this, but she was uploading 2 to 3 or 4 videos a day, which is insane. And that's just total, day in the life, walking around with the camera, hey, I'm at Disneyland, check me out kind of thing. But, her audience got used to constantly being able to check in and enjoy her content sort of in that format, that when she decided hey, this is a little bit too much, it ended up being a bit of a problem, right? And you don't want to fall into that situation where, you can't sort of, feed the beast, more or less, assuming you shouldn't call your audience the beast, but you, whatever you set sort of as your limit, you should stick to. And I think that yes, certainly, higher quality is good, but it's not necessarily necessary.
So you specialize in EDM and hip hop content. Now I would imagine that's pretty difficult to do on a real frequent basis in terms of songs anyway. Now I can see behind the scenes and things like that you can do, but just in terms of musical material, that must be especially difficult to do in that kind of frequency.
Yeah. Yeah. You're absolutely right. I think that with YouTube, it sort of boils down to, there's sort of an entertainment factor, which is, your behind the scenes, your tour video recaps, things like that. And then there's sort of a utility element to it as well, in that at the end of the day, YouTube is the largest platform for music discovery. And feel free to tell me that's not the case, and I will argue till,
No, I believe it.
To the bitter end, people go to YouTube to listen to music. And, if you're a musician, you can satisfy that on a regular basis, especially if you're in the electronic music space where, sort of the strategy now, it isn't really to release an album, it's to kind of regularly release content more over time in the form of sort of a single, which lends itself, in my opinion, good to YouTube. You could just upload a track with, static image of, a hot girl or your art or whatever it is, right? And you're satisfying, a content need on YouTube, which is more the utility side than sort of the entertainment side.
Well, that's one of the strategies that I preach in some of my music business books, that we've moved from an album society to a single society. But it helps you in so many ways, because if you release a single a month or every 6 weeks or even every 2 months, what ends up happening is each time it's an event rather than an album, which is one event for the year. Yeah. Now you can have a separate event, maybe 10 events over the year, and then compile it into an album for number 11. And that's so much better for the artist.
Yeah. I mean, you can sort of tease it out, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like
right.
you can release 5 or 6 album or singles and then release the album, you know, which is a 12 song album. Or yeah, you could never release an album and just constantly sort of release EP after EP. And that's something that has always lent itself well to electronic music, and in a lot of cases to hip hop. And it's how people are, you know, moving to consume music, you know, even in other genres too. I mean, pop being the sort of obvious example there. So
yeah. You're really close to electronic music then. Where do you see it going? Do you see it peaking?
See it peaking? It's an interesting question. I guess like the biggest question is like, is it a bubble? I honestly see it sort of going. I see it getting more complex, if that makes sense.
Splitting into different subgenres. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You've found ways to incorporate R&B. I mean, if you look at the new Coldplay release, which is, I think it's, I forget the name of it, but the newest Coldplay song that's being played on the radio right now, it's an EDM song, you know, and you know, it's finding its way into other genres. And I think that's indicative of sort of like what you saw happen with rock. Like, yeah. A lot of people today wouldn't just like be like, oh, I just like rock. It's like, I like metal. I like, it kind of branched out into sort of all of these other genres and incorporated other things. And I think that we're already there with electronic music. I think it's here to stay. I think that, you know, the term electronic music really just means putting more focus on doing it in the box, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And you know, as software continues to progress faster than hardware can, in my opinion, I think that, you know, that's something that isn't going to change.
Where does EDM stand in relation to other musical genres on YouTube in terms of popularity?
Yeah, that's a great question. So far and away, the most popular thing the most popular musical format on YouTube is, and successful, is cover musicians. Something I'm always sort of thinking about in this job is like, who is the audience on YouTube? And if I had to be honest, and it, you know, certainly sort of doesn't disappoint me, but, you know, I would say sort of is the lay of the land. The most active users on YouTube who actually go there for entertainment purposes and engage are, I would say, would be a 14-year-old girl. That's who I think sort of like the core audience has become in a weird way.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason cover music has become so successful is it's kind of a brilliant strategy. We work with an artist named Tyler Ward,
mm-hmm.
who I believe is around 2 million subscribers now. And he, you know, was an artist out in Denver, sort of singer-songwriter. And right before the Olympics happened, he covered We Are the World, because he said, hey, like, here, you know, the Olympics is about to happen. People are probably going to be searching for this on YouTube. And he blew up, you know. And then it kind of spurred this sort of thought process of, you know, oh, you have, you know, Lady Gaga, or you have some artist release a song, but it's going to take a month or two for the video to come out, and people are going to be searching for that song on YouTube. A cover musician can cover that song, you know, do a decent job of reproducing it and make a decent music video and upload it to YouTube before Lady Gaga can. And then that's going to, like, you're going to win the SEO game. And you know, that's sort of, since, because sort of that strategy works so well, you know, it sort of birthed all of these huge cover musicians who have sort of paved the way. So I think, you know, in a weird way at Full Screen, it's sort of like we have our people in the music department who deal with like the cover musicians, and then I'm kind of everybody else.
Okay.
You know,
I get it.
It's like, you know, I think that's where the largest audience lies. Not to say that people, you know, electronic music isn't huge and there isn't an audience for electronic music on YouTube, but I think certainly there's a larger audience for, you know, independent singer-songwriters on YouTube, generally sort of the new karaoke stars of our day.
It seems like labels and artists have caught on, though, the fact that lyric videos are very strong, or just a picture video, you know, a picture with the song behind it, are really powerful, and you can get them up day and date, you know, which is really important, mm-hmm. I think. So now what I've seen, record labels, when I talk to them, they all have that as part of their strategy. Okay, we're going to get, you know, a lyric video up. Doesn't cost much, it's real fast to do, and then we'll worry about the produced music video. So I think that's become a general strategy, or at least it's becoming that way, slowly but surely. Hey, do you see that in terms of lyric videos?
Yeah, I think you're right on. I think the labels have caught on to all of this. You know, they'd be stupid to not have done so. lyric videos are valuable. I would say, to be honest, maybe they were a little bit more successful in general. I would say maybe like 6 months to a year ago. Now, you know, that sort of used to be the mindset, like, oh, we need to have a lyric video for every single video that gets out there. Whether it's a lyric video or just, you know, the music just being on YouTube, I think it's every artist should absolutely 100% do that, whether you're a major artist or, you know, an indie artist. What is interesting, though, that most labels haven't caught on to, which I find really interesting, is these really big artists, and if you don't mind, I'm going to kind of like veer the conversation to where I would take it.
Yeah.
is all these, you have these artists who have created, you know, 1-3 million subscribers strong, you know, audiences on YouTube. And you have a lot of labels who are, in some instances, chasing these artists down because the PR is sort of built in. It's kind of like, for any label, it's their dream to distribute and work with, you know, artists like that. But what we're finding, which is really interesting, is that in a lot of cases, if you have a million, I mean, like, we can do the math really quick. If you have a million subscriber audience and you release an album for $10 and 1% of your audience converts, that's $100,000.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And in that case, with where distribution is, and you've built your PR from scratch, your audience from scratch, that's a decent living. You don't necessarily need a label to do all of those things for you. And that's something that, you know, I think at Full Screen and me personally, you know, we're interested in, is that, you know, what can you do yourself, you know?
Yeah, sure.
If that makes sense.
Of course, you know, that's the business Full Screen is in, is getting those artists and promoting those artists, because that's the bread and butter, basically.
Right. Well, building those artists, right?
Yeah,
It's all about, for us, like, what's the next level, right? Are you an artist with 100,000 subscribers? What can we do to get you to that, like, you know, half a million subscriber level, you know, what can we do with you when you get to that point? And, you know, it's development in a lot of cases.
At what level does it get interesting? Do you look at views? Do you look at subscribers? What is the criteria there?
Yeah, for a multi-channel network, it's pretty important when it comes to brands, because at the end of the day, YouTube is taking 45% of all of the ad revenue on everything that's being monetized on YouTube. And then if you can imagine, you know, Full Screen takes a small percentage of, this is sort of how the MCN business works, is YouTube takes its cut, then we take a small cut of our creators' ad revenue in exchange for offering these services. And when we bring a brand deal to the table, it's outside of YouTube. So it basically makes it so that we can, you know, reap the benefits of doing that direct with the YouTube creator. So what makes it interesting to us is how brand friendly you are. If you're a 100 or 200,000 subscriber channel, who's really, really brand friendly, and we can tell you, and you have a very unique story, then we might work with you in the same capacity that we would a million subscriber channel. You know, what it comes down to is how well we can help sell you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anytime you go to a brand and you can guarantee a million views, then you're in business, that's a really easy sell. But Fullscreen works with creators and brands on a from creators who are very, very small. We've worked with them on bringing in brands like less than 10,000 subscribers to, you know, the Fine Brothers and Lindsay Sterling and, you know, the largest musicians and channels on YouTube. We've done everything few and far between. So really it depends on the story. It depends on, you know, what about you we can help you sell. And if there isn't anything, and you know, brand integrations are interesting to you as a creator, what can we do to work with you to make you more brand safe and more brand friendly so that, you know, we can work towards that in the future.
When you started at Fullscreen, did you start in the gig that you're at now?
I did not. So I've had a sort of interesting, adventure through Fullscreen. I actually started in the production department, actually doing, editing, some shooting and actually some like content development. But prior to Fullscreen, I had my own business that was, a music technology business. And when some people at Fullscreen kind of caught wind of that, and an opening sort of came up here to sort of be in this role and oversee the electronic music community, you know, some people just sort of fought for it, and I ended up doing sort of a sidestep, if that makes sense, from actual sort of content production into, you know, the music industry side of stuff, which I was already a little, you know, I'd made my mistakes. Let's put it that way. I'd learned.
Yeah.
You know, so it was a pretty natural fit, and I'm very happy where I am now. So,
cool. Well. Yeah. That being said, let's talk about OutListen because it's such a great idea. Tell our listeners about OutListen.
Yeah, absolutely. So prior to Fullscreen, I had and actually continue to have a startup called OutListen. It's essentially a video processor for when fans are at a concert. We can crowdsource, synchronize, and then auto-edit their fan shot concert footage into a new video that turns the audience into the cameraman for the artist. So it's basically for artists, we can provide them a crowdsourced concert video, more or less.
That is so cool. Okay, so there's two questions I have then. The first one is, if that's automatically happening, and the cuts are happening automatically then, right?
Mm-hmm.
How did you figure out that algorithm? That's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, I can kind of give you the story. Basically, before I did OutListen, I was a full-time editor for television and digital and reality. So I came from an editing background. Basically, you know, I don't want to give away, you know, too much.
Yeah, sure.
But since how we're basically synchronizing all of these videos, theoretically, they're all recording the same audio. So there's actually something out there called Pluralize, which a lot of editors use, which will basically match up multiple video clips via the audio waveform.
It's called
a Pluralize.
Pluralize, okay.
So we do something very similar. So we're basically finding the similarities in the audio waveform, and if the quality of audio is good enough, we can create matches and synchronize the video clips. Then we also, we're doing things like analyzing the BPM of the audio to make sure that it's cutting, you know, relatively closer to the beat than it would normally, you know, things like that. But the thing that, you know, not a lot of people understand when it comes to editing is, you know, you can have two beautiful images, like two shots next to one another, but if the audio underneath is, you know, messed up, you're not going to be in the experience.
Yeah.
You could have two mediocre images, but if the audio underneath, you know, is, you know, real and it's there and it's consistent, then, you know, you can stay in that world. You know, the audio actually dictates a lot more than the video does when it comes to editing. So for us, it was more important to really make sure that, you know, when we do crowdsource this content, that the audio is, you know, normalized and makes sense and, you know, is as clean as possible, and then actually let the audio dictate more of, you know, how things are actually cutting, if that makes sense. And that happens in a number of different ways. But
so yeah. It's cutting audio and picture then, not just picture.
So it's not cutting audio. Basically, we can preference audio. So if we have let's say 10 angles, right? And we can say, okay, this is like the pro audio, or this is, we can bring in the mix more or less into it after the fact, and it will lay it in, and that will be the only form of audio. If not, it will actually normalize all of the sort of audio into one another and sort of kind of make sure it's sort of a consistent volume. So, and then, once we sort of have, once we know what that audio track, once the processor more or less knows what that, base audio track is, we do things to the audio to dictate how the video will cut to one another.
It's really cool though that you find a way to that you can cut close to the beat. One of the things that drives me crazy is when you have editors that have no feel for music and they're cutting all over the place and it just doesn't make sense. It makes me crazy. And what I found is that musicians tend to make good music editors anyway because they know where the beat is at least, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a saying in the film and TV world that most editors have a drumming background,
Yeah,
right?
makes
So
sense.
you understand rhythm,
Yeah.
that really helps. So, I mean, it's weird, man. We've gotten this thing to a point where it will spit back videos that will feel like I edited them. And that to me is just like, it's mind blowing. It's like, I'm helping phase myself out a little. So
That's incredible.
it's a weird experience, but yeah, you can definitely check that out. We're working on basically making the technology consumer facing so that anyone can use it. That should be happening within the next month. You can check that out at atlassian.com, or if you actually want to see what this content looks like, you can go to youtube.com/outlisten.com with the dot spelled DOT. So outlisten DOTCOM, if you want to check that out. So
I watched some of it before and it was great. It was amazing, actually.
Thank you. So it's been an interesting journey. And basically, for a while it was just convincing artists and brands to do custom crowdsource campaigns. And it's been a good ride, and we continue to do it, and it's a lot of fun.
I think one of the questions I would have with that, the crowdsourcing aspect I love, but do they get enough interesting angles for you?
That's a really good point. To be honest, I mean, I'll be completely honest, some videos come back and it's not the most interesting. And I don't know if that's a combination of the actual performance itself and maybe the angle is, say, too far away, or XYZ. But I'll tell you, man, there are times where videos come back and it's like just the most beautiful, intimate thing. You know what I mean? It's like you're right there with them. You hear the screaming, you hear the cheering, and I feel like it's come closer for me. I grew up on, like, I think, for instance, the Pink Floyd Pompeii, film is like one of the greatest, like, sort of concert albums of all time. And it's like it feels, in some instances, it just feels so intimate. You know what I mean? Like almost as intimate as a well shot, high quality, concert film. So, I mean, yeah, it really does depend on, what you feed in, the quality of content that gets fed into the processor. But yeah, I mean, there are times where it's absolutely breathtaking. And yeah.
I would think that there'd be other markets for this as well. Rather, music would be great and concerts would be great, but I'm sure there's other places you can go with this as
Totally.
well.
Weddings, sporting events, conventions. Is that sort of what you mean? Yeah, absolutely. Definitely tons of practical activation or applications. Music is the best market far and away, though, just because, for some weird reason, that's become something people want to do at concerts, is film. And it just happens more in music than anywhere else. But yeah, absolutely. We've experimented. We did something cool a while back. There was, I think, like maybe 2 4th of Julys ago in San Diego, there was a moment where, for some reason, all of the fireworks on the 4th of July went off in about like 30 seconds. Like there was this, it was a complete, some guy completely messed up, and it was just like this crazy psychedelic fireworks experience that was like imagine an entire night of fireworks in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And we, of course everyone whipped out their phones and, we crowdsourced that because, it was a similar audio going on. And that was really cool. Yeah. I mean, I think the applications for like citizen journalism is really, really interesting. But like I said, you're relying a little bit more on the people in the moment knowing to take out their phones or their cameras and capturing the same moment, which, lends itself better to music than anything else.
Well, how does that work then, Jeff? Do they upload it just to YouTube and you find it, or do they upload it to a certain site or a certain place on YouTube? How does that work?
Yeah, so currently it's built on YouTube. So it can go a couple different ways. What we've sort of done in the past to make money has been we would more or less build out web pages or sort of online experiences where people could directly upload their content, to Mike Snow or Neo or Melanie Fiona's a custom webpage. Mm-hmm. In which case we're hosting the video, we're doing it all. But what I have sort of to myself, which is kind of like my kind of master tool, is we're using an API. There's a company called setlist.fm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with them. Yeah. And we basically use their API. So I can like basically search for any artist. It will show me any show or, almost any show they've ever played. And then the set list through setlist.fm of that show. And I can say, hey, go to YouTube, find these, search, I can say, give me Beyonce at the Staples Center on July 10th. And I want the song, whatever, some Crazy in Love or, whatever one of her song is. And it will go to YouTube and it will grab the videos, crowdsource it and give it to me. And I can output it anywhere I want. And it's pretty cool. So yeah, and then also we're also pulling in information on the people that upload the individual angles as well. So when this does become consumer facing, if someone wants to output it back to their YouTube channel, it will also annotate, or if they want, it can annotate, or, in the description say, hey, this angle one was by, Jen X56, this is her channel. So, it links back to the people. It gives back to the people who shot those angles.
Yeah. I was just going to say, there must be a clearance issue in that, don't you think?
Yeah.
If it's a Beyonce song, for instance, publishing and there's performance and everything like that. But that being said, I mean, there's ways around it. So I guess your client would be the artist, right, in this case?
Yeah. So in the past, that's actually a big reason why we didn't choose to sort of set out and make a platform. Instead, we kind of chose to do it on an individual case by case basis, essentially trying to tap into marketing budgets of large artists. Or in some cases you get a brand involved and then they pay for the experience. We've certainly been doing it a bit of a more controlled setting, which has been good for us. The choice to make it consumer facing, we're the tool that enables an artist to do this, and we would hope that the artist who does do this and output this content to YouTube, they would have the okay and the rights to do so. On YouTube there are several tools. I don't know if you're familiar with Content ID.
No, of course.
That will basically safeguard against these things to make sure that revenues are sort of pointing in the correct direction.
Okay. Last question. This has been great so far.
I'm
really enjoying it.
Yeah.
What's the best piece of business advice that either you've learned along the way or someone gave to you?
It's a great question. I'll tell you what instinctively came to me, and then I'll probably come up with another idea. I mean, don't be afraid to fail and don't be afraid to do it yourself. I'm very happy and, blessed to be in a position that I am at Full Screen, working with amazing creators. But, I think at the end of the day, I learned far more building my own business and trying to, not care about clearance issues, but, actually set out and at least, create the potential for me to fail.
Yeah.
And, convince the right people to back me. And, like you learn more from those types of experiences, than maybe you do from a 9 to 5. And I think that, you know, going out and doing it yourself and not being afraid to fail would be sort of my one piece of advice to people. Because, I mean, it's all about finding gaps, right? Like, where's the gap? How can I make the world a better place? And, I mean, excuse my French, the world's a fucked up place. There's lots of gaps to fill, man. So, you know, how can we make, you know, how can we make when I wake up and feel groggy better? I don't know. You know, there might be a business there. I don't know. It's a horrible example, but so I think, yeah, you know, don't be afraid to fail. And, you know, certainly if you're young and you can take the risk. So
it's good advice.
Yep. I know it's not like the newest thing, but I truly believe that.
So. Well, and I believe it too. I believe it too, because that's the only way you learn is if you fail. So anyway, this has been great, Jeff. I learned a lot. I'm really happy that we got to talk because, you know, it was very cool and it's cool talking to you. So thanks so much for doing this. If you want to find out more about Jeff, go to LinkedIn/Jeff Ponchick. That's PONCHICK. You can also find out more about Outlisten by going to outlisten.com. That's one word, OUTLISTEN.com. It's very cool. Check it out. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. I really, really like anything that you can send me. I look at all the questions. I look at all the comments. And really, it helps me improve the show. So please send them whenever you have an idea. I'll really dig it. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who puts this whole thing together. He's the host of the Producer Podcast at theproducer.club. So in other words, that's one word, theproducer.club. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and 4 alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski, and I'll see you next time.